This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. As Martin Luther King Jr. Day approaches, community members in La Crosse are preparing for an annual celebration of the civil rights leader. Part of the festivities include a featured speaker, and this year that's David Dennis Sr., a retired attorney and activist from South Carolina. Dennis was a leader during the 1960s civil rights movement and after, working to empower African-American voters and improve their representation in politics. Joining us today to talk about his experiences and his message for the La Crosse community is David Dennis. Thank you so much for being here.
And how are you today?
Great. So the title of your lecture for this year's Martin Luther King Jr. celebration is What Does It Mean to Be an American? And I wonder if you could start us off by talking about how you hope to answer that question.
Well, that's the question that's been raised, especially under the new administration, and then looking at the evolution of the history of this country and in terms of how it's related to people of color. And so the question is where do you want? When we talk about make America great again, which really begin to raise that question, is what does that mean? For me, as an African-American, the past, my past experience in the past in American history, and my the roles that we played, you know, has not been what I consider to be great for me as part of a people. And so the question becomes, then, what is it that we want? So I looked at the 60s and the work that we did in the civil rights movement, people dying and going to jail and being beaten just to get the right to vote, or to sit at a lunch counter, to the right to public accommodations, the right to a first-class education, all came at a very, very high price. And so then we look at today, after all this in the past of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voters' Rights Act, and all the acts prior to that, and looking at where we are now, you know, I began to raise that question, you know, what type of America do we really want? Because if we're looking at the issues around the national anthem, and then I think about when we look at the Bill of Rights and we look at the preamble to the Constitution, and when it was written, what did it mean then to the writers? I mean, were we as a people, all of Americans and citizens really included? And when the preamble was written, when the original Constitution was formed, because at that time, we as a people were not considered to be a total human being. And then when I look at the national anthem, even, and I look at that is, and I read the third verse of the national anthem, I hear there, I see and hear a support for slavery. And so when I begin to look at those things, and people begin to talk about Make America Great Again, I had thought about in the 60s and the work that we did, maybe we had passed all of this, but then when you say Make America Great Again, does that mean going back to those times? Are we talking about something different and greater? And if so, what are we trying to do about it? And so that's where the question comes from. You know, what does it mean to be an American citizen? What does it mean to be an American in this day and age?
Why do you think this reflection is so important as, you know, we head into a new year?
I mean, this is a very bad time, not for just any one type of people or group of people in this country, but as America as a whole. And the world is looking at us. I mean, the world has been watching us for a long time. And in the 60s, you know, it was the greatest time for this country to really model to the world what it means to be an American. And that is in the Freedom Summer and the challenge of the Democratic Party in the seating areas. And when this country said no, when you had thousands of students around the country, both black and white, joining hands together, fighting for democracy. And when they denied the seating of the Democratic Party, I mean, this country has not been the same in terms of people, young people, and people as a whole of all colors beginning to raise the question. So there's a question about the Vietnam War, and there's a question about, you know, where we were going as a people, as a group in this country. So to me is that that's caused another type of an awakening. And so here we are again is, as we pass through those times, is we back again is the reason the same questions and issues, I mean, really, whereby there's a blatant slap in the faces in terms of what I think that democracy ought to be and should be. So America, people have to make a decision here. So we have that crossroads. And this year we got to shut down based on the factors of putting up a wall to keep people out. Is one thing is, you know, that's a very critical issue. The question here is, I mean, in terms of what we're doing, what's the symbolic representation of such a wall? And so we have to begin to think about this in a very serious matter is because now we're talking about our children and others. You know, I'm looking at a time whereby, you know, you got President of the United States is who talks about grabbing women and the disrespect of women is. And, you know, and you know, you can buy the privates and whatever you have is, and then looking at TV where mothers and grandmothers are wearing T-shirts with an arrow saying, "Grab this, Mr. Trump." You know, I mean, I'm like, what is going on here? Is, you know, I mean, the, you know, of the change and of being more blatant. I mean, one thing that's happened here now is with the where we are now is that there is no middle of the roads. I mean, you either for what is right and good for people as a whole is and a model for the world, or you're not.
You left college in 1961 to join the civil rights movement. How did you make that decision?
It was a difficult decision for me because I'm a product of a sharecropper's family. I was raised on a plantation farm outside of Shreveport, Louisiana. And when I went to school, I finished high school. I was the first one in my family to finish high school. So going to college was a big move. I mean, and I wanted to become an electrical engineer. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with the civil rights movement, not because I didn't care. It's because the fact is that I felt that here's my opportunity to move forward in the country is. And I sort of just got caught up in things is. And so in the Indigenous rights movement, it's almost like fate. I've just got caught up in it. I was in one day I was walking across campus of Dillard University, which is a historic black college in New Orleans. And there was a rally on campuses. The young lady was speaking, you know, and she was very attractive, so I decided I wanted to talk to her, and she was talking about the civil rights movement piece. And our first date to talk to was to take me to a CORE meeting in New Orleans. And there, from there, went in on a sit-in, and from there, joined the Freedom Rocks. And so it was all it had to do with the fact is of just being in the wrong place. There's a lot of connection to how that happened. But then the turning point was, I guess, was the Freedom Rides. I mean, went on the Freedom Rides. I was really caught up into the emotional piece. And I ended up in Montgomery on the night when the riots were going on there and the Klans and others were attacking the church and other in Montgomery. And we were the next day, and so it was Dr. King and a bunch of us. The decision is trying to be made in terms of whether the riots should continue. And some of the elders were saying we should not continue the riots. And it wasn't because they were afraid. It was more because of the fact is they were concerned about the welfare of the young people. And so I was there as one of the young people. And Diane Nash, James Bellow, and a group of the CORE people from the New Orleans CORE group, Jerome Smith, Doris Castle, who was the young lady who was speaking, that I was talking about earlier, and one of the Thompson sisters. And I was sitting there, and so when I talk about fate, it was and it's fate and faith here. And so trying to make that decision, and I was really torn because if I go on this ride, I probably would not finish school. The fact is, I am now in a situation is whereby I was sure that anyone who got on that bus, they were going to die. I mean, I think everybody in that room felt very strongly about that because of all the activities that were going on outside and reports we were getting in, and the Klansmen saying they were going to, no bus was going to make it into Mississippi. Well, in that room, I suddenly heard a voice, and I don't know who said it. It had to be someone in that room, but I've not been able to find out who that was. But what I heard was that there's not enough space in this room for both fear and God. And he said, make your choice. And so at that particular point, it was almost like, you know, getting some surge. It was like nothing else mattered. You know, this is God's work in the senses. And so that's where I went. And so from that point on, there was no turning back, and I volunteered to be on the first bus, and I've been volunteering ever since then. And so I'm not sure as to, a lot of people ask me the question is, what caused you to do it? And what is it going to take? And I want to be involved. What do you think I should do? I can't tell them that is. It's sort of you have to have the feeling and a commitment. And that's what I think a lot of the people had at that time. And what we need now is a resurgence of that type of commitment for change as the young people had in the 60s and stuff. And the other piece that is lacking is the family structure. And I'm not talking about biological family. One of the things that we had then, the people, both black people, and a lot of people as a whole, was strong family ties. And it wasn't just biological. I came up as a single parent, from a single parent to home. But I had a lot of daddies because we had real communities then. And since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, is we don't have those communities. They don't exist anymore. There are places where these young people live and poor people live, and they don't have any resources to have, be a true community. There aren't any parks. There aren't any places, recreational places. It's a place whereby infestation of violence and others, because there is another way, a place to turn, and the country has more or less turned their backs on. And seeing to me is that was an intentional act after the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Because what happened is country was put into places that put into place things, activities, and programs that really attacked the basic structure of the black community. At that time is you could get people to be very concerned about issues and march and demonstrate and if something happened in their communities. And so the idea was how you get to the fibers. So it went after the culture. You had the Monaghan report that blamed black people for the dysfunction of families, because the fact is that you talk about people come from single homes. Well, you know, that's how we were brought here. I mean, as slaves, and the first thing they did, slave owners did, was to separate the parents. So we had a strong bond, and that is which we call community or extended family. And so I had a lot of fathers, Mr. Jack, Mr. Brown, and others. If I did something wrong, you know, they caught me on and they chastised me for it. And a lot of mothers who did that. So we just weren't, we were children of the community. And we don't have that in this country anymore. And so we need to figure out a way is whereby we look at it in education. We have to be concerned not just about our own biological child, but we have to be concerned about all the children because they are children of the country. So I think that's one of the issues we have to deal with in terms of how do you change. When you talk about make America great again, we have to think about what we're talking about.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with David Dennis, a leader during the 1960s civil rights movement and the featured speaker at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration in La Crosse. David, you spoke about having to make that decision between taking a more active role in the civil rights movement and, you know, following your personal pursuits in college. And I wonder if you feel like young people today are facing similar questions, similar dilemmas about whether to speak up or take a more active role, or whether to just, you know, keep their head down and focus on their personal pursuits?
Well, yeah, I think they are. I think the issues are a little bit different. I think one of the obstacles to their dealing with them are a little bit different. And it's hard to put your finger on it. And in those days, segregation sort of slapped you in the face. You colored on his signs and you can't go here, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it was right there, dead in your face. But one of the things we had was people got to know each other a little bit better. You know, I think there were the cultural differences and other things, but we got to know. And the reason being is we spent more time. Families spent more time with each other. Now kids sit at a table, they walk with their heads down, they don't even see each other anymore. They're looking at these little technology. Cell phones and other texting and things of that nature. People don't have personal conversation. Most of us at a distance. And so the whole world has changed to a large extent. We used to be able to sit and have dinner together and talk with each other, whether or not you're biological family, or neighbors, whatever you have is. We don't do that anymore. It's all in front of a TV set. It's all in front of iPads and what we have is, and so there's a lack of conversation, and so there's not conversation in the classroom. So teachers are not, really developing personal relationships. Teachers don't know a lot of the students, especially students working from the bottom quartile of poor students, because they don't even live in the same communities anymore. So we don't have this disconnected. So you have people coming in, have no idea of who they're coming in contact with, and saying they're going to try to teach them, without understanding who they're trying to teach. So therefore, is the whole communication gap between human beings and people today is much, much different than it was then. So in some way, through all this maze of problems and issues, in addition to the prejudices that exist in the country today and the world, we've got to figure out how to bridge this gap. I mean, how do young people communicate not only with each other, but with the adults? How do we begin to bridge this particular gap? And that's not an easy question, because it's something that's moving through the institutions, that deal with people, even the churches. I mean, most of the churches now have moved out of poor communities, and now they're called mega churches and exist on the outside of it. So you don't even have that, the basic for places where these kids, young people live in. So how you do this, we've got to figure this out, because it's not on this country, but the world is depending upon whether or not human beings can begin to deal with each other, as human beings. So when you say make America great again, at one time as part of the people, not considered to be whole human beings. So are we talking about moving back to that? And so this whole technology and everything else we have, is not saying you can get rid of technology. The question is how we can begin to frame, minds and so that we don't let technology control us, but we figure out how we can control technology to the betterment of man.
You were arrested over 30 times while helping to register disenfranchised voters during the civil rights movement. And I wonder what your thoughts are on Americans' ability to vote today. Do you think we see the same numbers of disenfranchised voters today?
Yes, I think, and it's a little bit different. I mean, the disenfranchisement is in the 60s is people were actually killed for trying to get people to register voters. They were actually killed and murdered attempted to register vote themselves. During the 60s, when I was working in Mississippi and Louisiana, we lost over 19 people. You only hear about a few. Medgar Evers, I was with him, just a couple of hours before he was killed. And Cheney Goodman Swerner, I was with them, the night before they were killed. And so I knew people who were, involved in the movement and, who died and things, in their efforts to get people registered to vote the fact is to register to vote themselves. So today is a little bit different, the disenfranchisement. It comes in another forms, and you have it whereby trumped up charges on people is, and you know, there is, you know, the felony charges and going to jail. I mean, you got large numbers of, we have the largest population of incarcerated people in the world is in the United States of America. And we have that, and then the whole piece of people just being, when you do register to vote, is to question a lot of people can have no, why vote? I mean, so the dilution of the power of that existing, you know, is happening every day. So you're looking at elections, I mean, now, Florida, Georgia, you know, I mean, it's quite obvious of things that are going on that's not right, and that is why people's votes are not being counted in North Carolina. Then you got the whole issue of whether or not foreign countries are beginning to hack into the voter registration pieces. So people begin to say, what the hell, why? You know, so the disenfranchisement is coming on a whole different way. It's, you know, it's a whole psychological piece, a lot of it is. And so we've got to figure this out because, I mean, at the present time is, what does it mean to rule? And now you got the whole issue, just party. You have people suffering now because in the country is shut down almost is because parties, you know, Democratic, Republican parties, all about the party. Well, nobody's talking about what is right about the people. You know, when we talk about we the people, who are the people? So I think that the, you know, the disenfranchisement is different. It's more subtle, but it's also just as deadly. And so people need to have some wake-up call. And I think, though, we begin to see more young people really begin to raise the question. I mean, they are going to have to begin to make a demand and a change in this country. And so when I look at the work of HBCUs, there is the David Goodman, the Andrew Goodman Foundation is doing a lot of work with the college students about voter registration and voter education. And I've watched students in the past elections, like in New Orleans, you know, not only register to vote, but marching into the in the rain and all the cast their votes. And then, you know, I see, I think there's beginning to be, there's becoming a, some type of an awakening of young people begin to raise the question about what's going on.
Yeah, what advice do you have for the next generation of, you know, community leaders fighting for civil rights?
Well, I think they need to raise the question. And so the issue is not just complaining. I mean, the powers to be is that the what's happening is at the local level. That's where the organizing needs to happen is. So we should be running people for everything from dog catcher on up is. And we need to also be more concerned about it, not just looking in from the outside. We need to be attending every school board meeting, every city council meeting. And I'm not just talking about adults. I'm talking about students. Students from the universities and students from the high schools, the middle schools, everything that's happening out there is impacting their lives. So they need to be present, and they should be demanding that the local officials, the elected officials, begin to respond to their needs. And so one of the things, ways they need to do is just as been doing with some of the young people around the gun control pieces. We need to begin to organize at the local level is, and the young people begin to make a demand upon the system and upon the leadership. So that's one of the things we can do. I mean, from the churches on in, you know, wherever young people have as an audience, have an opportunity to raise an audience, they should begin to organize at the local level is. I mean, I don't care if it's just for trying to get a park, to clean a place for them to play and have fun. Even just to a recreational place. I mean, they need to begin to make the demand of the local officials to be able to put in place those things that they need in order to be citizens.
Activist and retired attorney David Dennis Sr. is here with us today ahead of his appearance at La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Coming up, we'll hear from past recipients of La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Leadership Award about how the honor has influenced their lives. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers.